You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
If you have a Bible, keep it open to John 14, where it was just read, and we're open there because that's where we're going to spend a little time today. But before we do, I want you to take a moment just to imagine something. And what I want you to think of or imagine is a kite, a big, colorful kite that's just kind of soaring upwards toward the sky. The wind is underneath it. It's going up, up, up toward the heavens. It's free. It's the sky is the limit as it soars upward. It's just flitting, you know, to the right and then to the left. It's twirling. It's kind of doing loops. And if this kite were a person, you would say, man, he's having a great time, right? This guy is doing what he is made to do. He's loving it. He's so free. He's so joyful. He's living into who he's meant to be. And then all of a sudden, there's this tug on the kite. And the kite realizes that there's this string attached to it. And the string is kind of annoying to the kite because the string is really restrictive. Right, because it's not allowing the kite now to go wherever it wants. It's not allowing the kite to do whatever it wants to do. It's in many ways guiding the kite, and in many ways it feels like it's kind of holding it back, which is really frustrating and annoying. Now, so let me ask you, if you are the kite, is the string your friend or your foe? How do you see the string? For the past 4 weeks, we have been, as a church, asking some difficult questions about God. As part of what's called the Explore God initiative, maybe you've seen billboards around the city. Explore God is just a partnership with 350 Austin area churches that have been inviting others into a conversation about God and asking difficult questions. And this is our fourth and final week to take part in this. And our question, it's printed there in your liturgy that we're addressing this week, is Christianity too narrow for our culture? In other words, do claims of absolute truth, do they shackle people in some way in their pursuit of human freedom? Is the kite string too restrictive? In the Gospel of John, which we've spent a lot of time in this fall, Jesus makes lots of absolute statements about himself and about truth. He says a lot of exclusive, narrow-sounding stuff. For example, he says this in John 18. He says, everyone on the side of truth listens to me. In other words, if you want to be on the truth team, you better be on my team. Remember, he's on trial before Pontius Pilate when he says this. And you remember Pilate's response? What is truth? Which could be a question right out of our own culture. What are you talking about, truth? Like, your version of truth? What are we talking about here? Jesus says stuff like, I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved. I'm the entry point to salvation. I am the front door. You must walk through me. Really exclusive claim, narrow sounding stuff. Ron just read John 14:6. Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And this kind of narrow, exclusive sounding talk, it kind of grates, kind of chafes against the sensibilities of our culture. Because you read John 14:6, I'm the way and the truth and the life, and you think, well, if I'm going to be a Christian, then that means Christianity is going to tell me a number of things. It's going to tell me, number one, how to live, because it says Jesus says I'm the way. It's going to tell me what to believe, because Jesus says I'm the truth. It's going to tell me where to find my identity and my hope in life, because Jesus says I am the life. And that doesn't sound good to a lot of 21st century Americans committed to values like individual freedom, like the individual pursuit of happiness. Because I hear that and I think, what about my choices? Like, what about self-determinism? Isn't life what you make of it? What about all the different versions of truth out there? How am I supposed to just land on one version of truth? Isn't Christianity too narrow? Before we go any further, I need to acknowledge this. Over the centuries, Christianity and Christians have at times been too narrow in a way that's wrong. Christianity and Christians have used truth in an arrogant way. They've used truth as a bludgeon. Christians have been exclusionary. Christians have been judgmental. Christians have prescribed rules and behavior that God never intended. That's been, you know, rules and behavior that's more about our own preferences and our own opinions than God's will. And unfortunately, I think we Christians are susceptible to what every human being is susceptible to. We are hypocritical. We are judgmental. We are exclusive at times. Sometimes we assert our opinions and our preferences as universal truth. And I want to say this. If you have been wounded by Christians in these ways, I'm sorry, right? That kind of narrowness is wrong. It's sinful, right? And so it's possible that there is a narrowness out there that is completely wrong, and maybe you have experienced that. However, I don't want the sin of Christianity and Christians to sort of skew the way we answer this question today. And so I want to focus for a moment not on Christians, but I want to focus on Christ himself. And I want to ask the question, is he too narrow for our culture? Is Jesus too narrow for the culture that we live in? And in John 14, we have what might be the most memorable and most exclusive claim that Jesus ever made about himself. He claims to be the way to God here. Let's look at it together for a moment. Look at John 14, starting in verse 1. The scene here is that Jesus is in the upper room. He's having his last supper with his disciples. He is going to be arrested later that evening. He knows that he's going to die soon. He is teaching and encouraging his disciples. Back in chapter 13, he's told them that he's going away. And so his disciples are discouraged. They're fearful. They're uncertain. And so Jesus wants to encourage them. And this is what he does in John 14. Look at verse 1. He says, "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me." Or trust in God, have faith in God, have faith also in me. Now here comes the encouragement. He's about to tell them in verse 2 and 3 why their hearts don't need to be troubled. "In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and I will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also." So he's going away for a time. It says he's going to the Father, but then he's coming back and he's going to take his friends to be with him that they might be where he is, which is the best thing they can imagine, right? The greatest picture of heaven that they can imagine is to be with Jesus. Wherever he is, that's heaven. That's where we want to be. And Jesus promises that. Did you notice, though, how many times in his attempt to encourage them and give them hope, how many times he talks about himself and what he's going to do? Look at these two verses again, verse 2 and 3. Look how many times he focuses on himself. "In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be there also." 7 times in 2 verses, he's talking about himself. Is he self-absorbed? Like, is this arrogance? Is he delusional that he's tying all of their future hopes to him and to what he's going to do? It's kind of exclusive. Verse 4, "And you know the way to where I'm going." You know the path, you know the road, you know how to get to where I'm going. Verse 5, "Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way?" And I'm so thankful that Thomas is willing to say what everyone else in the room is thinking. Not sure where you're going, right? So how are we supposed to know the way? And Jesus is like, "Well, I just told you where I was going. Going to the Father. And you know the way." And Jesus says in verse 6, "I am the way. No one comes to the Father except through me. I am the path. I am the road." Jesus is not saying, "I point you in the way." He's saying, "I am the way." He's not giving directions. He's not saying, "You go down here and take a right on this next street, then take a left, go about a mile, and then you're going to take a left." He's not saying this is how you're supposed to live. He's saying, I'm the road. Hop on me, follow me, wherever I lead, don't veer from me, and you'll get to God. I'm the way. That is a highly exclusive claim. And if that's not true, that is offensive. You and I should close our Bible right now and be offended by that, if that is not true, because he is claiming to be the way to God. Now, he doesn't stop there. He says two other things about himself to sort of, I think, support and to amplify what it means that he's the way to God. He says, I am the truth, and then he says, I am the life. And we just have a little bit of time left, and I want to focus on those two things. Jesus is the truth, and Jesus is the life, because I think they amplify what he's saying about being the way, but I think they also amplify the offense that Jesus brings to our culture and that Jesus brings really to any culture. Jesus says, I'm the way to God because I am the truth of God and I am the life of God. All right, so let's look at first that he's the truth of God. In verse 6, Jesus says, I am the truth. Anytime someone claims to know the truth in our culture, I think it raises suspicion in our minds. It's like it's the tug of the kite string. You know, we're not sure we really like that. This guy's claiming to know the truth. Wait, what are you saying? You're saying that what you believe is true, therefore other beliefs are false? Not sure I like that. And we don't really, in our culture, want anyone to have that kind of certainty, because certainty can lead to arrogance. It can lead to feelings of superiority. Certainty can lead to divisiveness. And in the very worst cases, that kind of certainty about truth can lead to oppression. And we've seen this happen in history. And so sometimes when it comes to matters of truth, it feels like the prevailing cultural value is to choose uncertainty over certainty, right? Like the humble position to take is to say that I'm not sure I know what the truth is. And you hear it in our everyday language. And just the vernacular of the way we talk in our culture. We use words like kinda, right, or sorta, or like, just to kind of soften what we're saying, because I don't want you to think I'm trying to make a true statement here. It's just kinda true, what I'm saying. And sometimes we use I don't know as a filler. And so we'll say something like, well, God is like kinda, sorta, you know, I don't know, holy, right? You know, and maybe like sort of loving also, right? Because we don't want to be seen as asserting absolute truthful statements. And so we hedge a little bit. And the reason we experience truth claims as being difficult in our culture is because we live in a religiously pluralistic society. And you know what I mean by that. That just means there's a plurality, a diversity of views of truth in our society. In our society, we have living together amongst each other, Muslims, Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, Jews, atheists, pantheists, spiritualists, agnostics, et cetera, all living in the midst of each other. There's a diversity of views of truth out there. Alistair McGrath, who's a theologian, he makes a helpful distinction between what he calls descriptive pluralism and prescriptive pluralism. And he says descriptive pluralism is just describing things as they are. Our society has a diverse religious makeup to it. Everybody's invited to the table. Everybody's a part of the dialogue. Not one view of truth is legislated or enforced, right? Which is a good thing. I don't want anyone to be forced to believe the Bible, just like I don't want to be forced to believe the Quran. So it just describes things as they are. But he says prescriptive pluralism tends to take it a little bit further and begins to prescribe pluralism as the best and the right view of things. And so pluralism prescribed would say that all religion, all views of truth must be promoted as equally valid. And so you have your truth and I have my truth. And if your truth differs than my truth, then I must say that your truth is as true as my truth. Otherwise, I'm being intolerant, right? The pluralist wants to say, the inclusive view of truth is to say that all truth is equally valid, equal playing field. The story that's used sometimes to illustrate this or told that a pluralist might use is the story of the blind men and the elephants. or in the elephant. And maybe you've heard this story before. A king brings in three blind men to sort of examine an elephant and to describe what they, you know, how they experience this elephant. And the first blind man grabs the leg of the elephant and is like, "Ah, it feels kind of like a tree. It's real sturdy." And another blind man grabs the trunk of the elephant and says, "No, it's real malleable, and it's almost like it's rough though. It's like a snake." And the other blind man grabs the tail of the elephant and says, "No, I think it's more like a rope." And the lesson of the story is simple. It's that all religions only see a part and can only describe a part of what's true. Because one religion sees the whole elephant. They can only describe a portion of the truth. And so they all add to the conversation, but none of them can see the elephant as it is. Here's the problem with that illustration. The story is told from the position of the king who can see the elephant. Right? How would you know that those other guys aren't describing the whole elephant unless you could see the whole elephant? And so the story is told from the position of the pluralist who can't know that all religions don't know all truth unless they can see all truth themselves. The pluralist is claiming to know a version of the truth that no one else can see. And so the pluralist, in his attempt to be inclusive, ends up excluding the other versions of truth, doesn't he? Because he relativizes them. He makes them relative to what his absolute view of truth is. If you say that all views of truth are the same, or essentially saying the same thing, then in a sense you neuter all views of truth, all religions, all worldviews. If you say that a Muslim and a Christian are essentially saying the same thing, just in different ways, you do a disservice to the Muslim, to the belief of Islam and the belief of Christianity. Right, because a Muslim friend of mine does not embrace the Trinity as being central to their view of God. They say that the Trinity is not right. And as a Christian, the Trinity is foundational to my understanding of who God truly is. See, the Muslim and I can be friends, we can love one another, we can live amongst one another, and we can also disagree about what's true. But we dare not water down each other's beliefs and say, it's all kind of the same stuff. All truth claims, I want you to catch this, all truth claims are necessarily narrow. Like even the truth claim of the pluralist who's claiming to be wide, it is a narrow, exclusive claim. And so we need to ask, how is it that we can know the truth? How do we come to know truth, specifically truth about God? Is truth kind of just worked up and created by us? Is truth somewhere deep down in us hidden and we just need to uncover it? Or is truth outside of us such that it needs to be revealed to us? And I want to submit to you that to know anything about God, the only way we can know anything about God is if he reveals himself to us. This is what makes Jesus unique in his claim to be the truth. Because he doesn't say, "I tell the truth." He says, "I am the truth. I'm truth in the flesh. I'm truth incarnate." In other words, Jesus is claiming in his person to reveal the truth of who God is. John 1:18 says this, "No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son who is himself God, and at the Father's side, he has made him known." So what's that saying? It's saying that Jesus narrates God to us because he is God. Jesus explains God to us because he is God. Jesus reveals God to us. Jesus is the gracious self-disclosure of God himself. He's God's word made flesh. God says, "Hey, you want to know who I am, what I look like? Look at Jesus. He is the visible image of the invisible God. He's the truth." And I want to say that if Jesus is really the truth, if his claim to be the truth is true, then he's not too narrow for our culture. He's wide. Because he's explaining and revealing God as he really is. Nothing could be wider than revealing the mysterious, eternal God of the universe, right? Nothing could be wider than describing the indescribable. And that's what Jesus claims when he says, "I'm the truth." And so maybe truth is like that tug of the kite string, and truth protects us from the destruction that falsehood leads us to. Running into a power line or something, you know, taking a nosedive to the earth. Maybe truth helps us narrate or, you know, navigate just the destructive winds of falsehood around us. Maybe truth is our friend and not our foe. Jesus is saying in John 14:6, I am the way to God because I'm the truth of God. But he also says one more thing about himself. He says, I am the life of God. John 14:6, I am the way, I am the truth, and then lastly, I am the life. And this is also so offensive in our culture because our culture loves freedom, individual freedom. Our culture loves the idea of self-definition. And what do you mean when you say, I'm the life? Like, are you trying to tell me how to live my life? Are you trying to tell me that you're the meaning of life? Here's the definition of that word life when Jesus says, I'm the life. This is from Thayer's Greek Lexicon. Jesus is saying, I am the absolute fullness of life, both essential and ethical, which only belongs to God. You see how offensive that is? He's saying, I am life in its essence, in its very nature. Intrinsically, I have the God life in me. And I'm also life in an ethical sense. I am the ethical standard of life for all human beings. That is so offensive. If that's not true, that's what he means when he says, I am the life. You know, people read that and they think, well, Jesus, I liked you better when you were just like healing people, right? Feed some 5,000 here and there, be nice to tax collectors and adulteresses. But now you're asking me you're telling me how to live my life? That is not cool, Jesus. Not sure I like that. Because what about my freedom? What about my ability to define myself, to do what I want to do, to live as I see fit? Christianity seems narrow to our culture because it says that true life is found in Jesus and it rules out the other options. Christianity seems narrow to our culture because it says that Jesus is the ethical standard for all people for all time. Christianity seems narrow to our culture because it says that Jesus is the Lord of life, the master of life, and we're not. And this is an affront to us, to our idea of individual freedom, because we don't want restraints. We don't want limitations on our freedom. We want to be able to do what we want to do when we want to do it. We want freedom. Here's the deal with freedom, though. Freedom is actually not just getting to do whatever we want whenever we want. Freedom is not the absence of restraints or limitations. Freedom is actually just living with the right restraints, right, and the right limitations. For example, you know, a fish cannot say, I think I'm going to move up onto the lawn. You know, I'm going to start living up there now, right? I'm moving up into the woods because I'm tired of living in the water. Freedom is living according to how you're made, how you're designed, your very purpose. A fish is designed to take oxygen out of the water, and so a free fish is the fish that is restrained, limited to water, living according to how they're made. Freedom for us is to live according to how we're made. Jesus promises that. Jesus sets us free to live according to our purpose in the way that we're made. Colossians chapter 3, it says that when we're joined to Christ by faith, when we become a Christian, we're given a new self. And in Colossians 3, it says it's a self which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. In other words, he's restoring us to live in the way that we're made to live, in the way that we're created to live. Romans 8 says that in Christ, we're being conformed, we're being molded to the image of Jesus, the only perfect man who lived the only perfect life. We're being molded to him that we might live as we're intended to live. That's how Jesus offers us life. And we have freedom to walk in that in him. And so I think the kite string, we could say it kind of helps the kite be what the kite is made to be. Actually, the kite never gets off the ground. The kite never soars without the string. And the kite does not exist for itself. The kite exists for the enjoyment and the pleasure of the one who is flying it, and the string makes all that possible. Jesus is the life. I want to say that Jesus is not too narrow for our culture. I would say actually that our culture in any culture is actually too narrow for him. Because no culture can offer the kind of life that he is offering, and yet every culture is looking for it and longing for it, right? Every culture, ours included. I think a good example of this is the ACL festival that's been in town these past 2 weekends, which got canceled today, so bummer for some of you who might be ticket holders. It was canceled because of the rain. I think ACL is a wonderful picture of this because what you have at ACL, you have thousands of people gathering each day. I think there's 70, 75,000 that gather on a single day down there to sing, to dance, to enjoy music. There's great food. It's a foodie city, and some of the vendors that are providing just wonderful food and beverages. It's in a garden-like park in a city with the skyline, beautiful skyline in the background. There's a river running through the city. Some of the best musicians of the world are here, you know. Last Sunday night, and it would have been tonight, you know, the National is here, one of my favorite bands. Love those guys. Phoenix was playing on Sunday night. Nico Case was playing. They shut down last Sunday night with the great Lionel Richie, right, of Commodores fame. All night long, right? That's how they shut it down, I think, last week. People laughing, enjoying one another. It's life happening. But I want to say that what is going on over there at ACL is really just a shadow of what they're really looking for and longing for. I think when you go to something like that or any event like that, you think, man, this is great. But I sense deep down in my soul that there's something higher, something beyond, something further back that I'm looking for. And it's because it's the life that only Jesus can offer, and no culture can create it on its own. See if this describes it. In Revelation chapter 21 and chapter 22, these are the last two chapters in the Bible. John is writing, the same John that wrote the Gospel of John, and he says, I saw a holy city. So this scene takes place in a city just like the ACL festival does. New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. We found out earlier that every culture is represented in this gathering, in this city around the throne of God. Every culture that the world has ever known, every tongue, every language, every tribe is represented there. See, Jesus, he doesn't eradicate culture, he enhances culture. He brings it into fullness of color and life. And we see every culture represented here. And it says, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. There shall be no more mourning or crying. No, pain will be no more, for the former things have passed away. And he who was seated on the throne, that is Jesus, said, behold, I'm making all things new. All things, everything, I am making new. I'm redeeming all that's broken. I'm fixing it and making it new again. And then in chapter 22, the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. So this city also has a river running through the middle of it. Also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. So there's good food there. There's abundance there. There's stuff happening. There's just people loving being a part of this. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. Again, all cultures, all peoples represented here being made whole, being healed. No longer will there be any accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads, and night will be no more. They'll need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. And that's it. That is the eternal festival, right, that we are all invited to. That is the kind of life that Jesus promises. Jesus says, behold, I am making all things new. That's not narrow. That's why all things includes all things. That's as wide as you can get. See, Jesus is not exclusive. He's inclusive. He's opened his arms wide on the cross and invited all to come to him for life. Jesus can say, I'm the way to God, because he is the truth of God and he is the life of God. He is wide in his invitation. And I want to end. I want to end by illustrating John 14:6, this verse that we've looked at, with a scene from a C.S. Lewis story. Some of you have read the Chronicles of Narnia, the most, you know, obviously the most famous book from Chronicles of Narnia is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But the fourth book in the Chronicles of Narnia is called The Silver Chair, and probably less of you have read that book. But there's a scene in The Silver Chair, and I just wanted to read you a little excerpt from another book talking about this scene, and it describes what we've been talking about today. And so in this story, The Silver Chair, there's a girl named Jill, and Jill has come into this strange, magical country at the top of this great mountain, and she's wandering around, and over time, she's trying to find some water to drink because she's really thirsty. And she comes upon this this brook, this bubbling brook, but there's this huge lion laying down between her and the bubbling brook. And she is so thirsty, and she so wants to get water, but she's afraid of the lion, and she's not willing to try to walk past the lion. And the lion asked her if she's thirsty, and she says, "Man, I'm dying of thirst." "And then drink," the lion tells her, but she's too afraid to move toward him. And so she quickly realizes, she asked him, "You know, do you mind like moving down a little bit while I go, you know, have a drink?" And she realizes how presumptuous this is. It says she might as well have asked the whole mountain to move aside for her convenience. But the water is just making her more thirsty and more thirsty. And so Jill asked the lion if he'll promise not to do anything to her if she comes to the stream and drinks. But the lion says that he makes no promises. And she's frantic with thirst, and she comes closer and closer. And then she asks the lion, "Do you ever eat girls?" And the lion responds matter-of-factly, "I've swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms." And so Jill tells the lion, "Well, then I dare not come and drink. I don't think I can come past you." And the lion replies to her, "Then you're going to die of thirst." And she says to him, "Well, I suppose I must go and look for another stream." But the lion replies, "There is no other stream." That's what John 14:6 is all about. There is no other life. To get to the life of God, you have to go through the lion. It's both wonderfully exclusive and wonderfully inclusive, because on the other side is the life of God, and he invites us to come to him. Let's pray.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.